Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, September 19th. I'm your reader, Glorietta. Let's take a look at today's weather. Today, high of 89, low of 65. Sunny today, wind subsiding, warm and humid. Expect a full day of sunshine with relative humidity 75% early, 40% in the afternoon, and good drying conditions. A moonlit sky tonight, average relative humidity 75%, strong thunderstorms tomorrow afternoon. Monday will be a high of 73, low of 48. Tuesday, high of 69, low of 42. Wednesday, high of 67, low of 42. And Thursday, high of 71, low of 48. So not a terrible week this week, everybody. Let's take a look at the top stories from the front page. Top stories include new MCHS group has links to extremism. Center of the page, someone will die. And bottom of the page, Kleseth was dedicated to Mason City Schools. Let's take a look at that middle story, someone will die. Emails show city's worry over safety of downtown building. In an August 12th email to Mason City Chief Building Official Kurt Suave and Development Services Department Director Stephen Van Steenhuis, Mason City Administrator Aaron Burnett was blunt. He said, please call him one last time to see if he intends to comply with the request or respond to any correspondence from the city. I plan on turning Steve Linger loose next week, Burnett wrote in a 11:21 a.m. email. The him refers to Vance Jurgensen, the agent representing Highway 18 LLC, the deed holder for the property also known as the Letts Spencer Smith Company building on the corner of South Federal Avenue and 5th Street Southeast. Part of the parapet of the downtown historic warehouse building collapsed on June 29th, forcing sidewalk and lane closures on nearby streets and generating questions about the safety of the building in general. Steve Lettinger, who the city was looking to turn loose, is an attorney for the Cedar Rapids-based law firm Lynch Dallas. Lettinger's profile on that site states that he frequently represents cities and counties on matters of code enforcement, nuance abatement, and abandoned properties, to name a few. By the time Lettinger's name was invoked in one of the emails that the Globe Gazette was provided following an information request, it had been about a month and a half since the collapse. Just one day prior, on August 11th at 11:58 a.m., Burnett sent an email to Jurgensen that had Suave, Van Steenhuis, and Lettinger copied. At one point in the message, Burnett writes, as this is a dangerous condition being created by the inaction on the building, please provide an update on your actions to correct the failures in the building as soon as possible. Jurgensen did not respond to requests for comment sent by the Globe Gazette on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of this week. In the first few days after the collapse, there was a flurry of action within various city departments and a suggestion that matters could be solved without a lot of back and forth. On June 30th at 3:53 p.m., Mason City House Inspector Zoning Administrator Ray Quayle wrote to Burnett and copy Van Steenhuis, Mason City Police Chief Jeff Brinkley, and Mason City Engineer Mark Graham in an email that relayed a conversation Quayle said he had with Jurgensen earlier that day. He stated that he has in his policy an addendum for sudden collapse of his building, so it sounds like it will be covered. Quayle then went on to say, though, that it was unknown how long it would take for things to get in motion. Leading into the July 4th holiday week, there was a recommendation from an engineer with Pi Consulting and Engineering out of Eden Prairie, Minnesota, hired by Jurgensen to inspect the building. At 6:25 p.m. on July 2nd, Aaron Kellis, an engineer for Pi, informed Jurgensen and Suave via email that portions of the remaining parapet walls were compromised because of eroded mortar joints and that conditions in certain areas were such that there was a public safety risk. It is recommended that the adjacent traffic lanes, sidewalks, and alleyway remain closed until the remaining portions of the compromised parapet wall and east exterior wall can be stabilized and or repaired or replaced, Kellis wrote near the end of his email. After a few days of fireworks and celebrating the nation's independence, city discussions picked back up again on July 7th. That day, at 2:58 p.m., Suave let Van Steenhuyse Burnett and Mason City's assistant engineer, Steve Onley, know that Jurgensen hired Dave Randall Construction to make repairs to the building and that the engineer would have a final report completed that afternoon so that officials could begin crafting a stabilization plan for the parapet. Within the documents, the Globe-Gazette received the next conversation involving that construction company doesn't appear until July 21st, when Suave tells Van Steenhuyse and Quayle that Randall would take down the rest of the parapet and further clean the alleyway where debris fell. He was going to look at the rest of it, but I haven't heard from him yet. He did mention that he has three jobs behind, Suave wrote. About 30 minutes later, with Burnett, Rim, and Brinkley added to the chat, Suave relayed the following information. I just spoke to Vance. He just had Dean Snyder Construction assess it and give him a bid that the insurance company required. His insurance is going to cover the collapse, but he will be responsible for any other work done. He is going to ask Dave Randall to do whatever it takes to make the rest of the parapet stable ASAP, so that we can get the all clear to open the streets. That same day, July 21st, Burnett called the situation an emergency. Hire someone else to elevate the threat to the public if Randall is not available, he wrote. Someone will die if this traffic situation is allowed to continue. I want legal engaged to start the pressure if the date of work beginning is not within the next week. This has already gone on too long. The next dialogue Jurgensen started with the city came on July 30th at 12:16 p.m. His proposal to Burnett, in part, through email, would you agree to our having settlement discussions regarding the situation with the warehouse? It would be good to be able for us to have a frank settlement discussion, like a mediation, but without a third-party mediator or need for counsel. Nothing discussed by either of us would be binding or admissible unless an agreed resolution is reached and later approved by the parties we each represent. He also asked Burnett to keep the discussion private. Burnett's response to Jurgensen's pitch came the next day. I have spoken with our attorney, and I appreciate your willingness to talk with the city to find a resolution. Unfortunately, I do not believe that any conversation would be protected from inquiries, and I am concerned as this request is coming after no plan was provided that gives a date certain to the building being stabilized. Following that exchange, there isn't another email between the two before August 11th, when Burnett says that Jurgensen hadn't responded to the July 31st message and that the city still needed an update on plans. On August 16th, Burnett lets Jurgensen know that WHKS would conduct a structural evaluation the following day and was entering the building with a key provided by Jurgensen. Burnett reiterated the city's request for information or documents related to building modifications and blueprints. Burnett then concluded his email, I appreciate the access for this important evaluation and would again request that you provide plan ASAP for stabilizing the structure to ensuring the safety of the public. As far as the public goes, numbers from the Iowa Department of Transportation show travel figures in the four-digit range for the section of Highway 122 U.S. 18, 5th Street Southeast, that goes by a warehouse in Mason City. Just before the intersection on 5th Street, a Federal Avenue to the east, the annual average daily traffic counts are 6,400 and 8,000 based on 2017 data. According to the IDOT, Krista Billhorn, such counts are what a person could expect to see daily. Every 4 years, the department will take a new count. Those numbers will be available next summer after all the averaging, Billhorn wrote in an email. Earlier this week, the Globe-Gazette had three main questions for Burnett about the historic warehouse. Where do things currently stand with cleanup? When is the city hoping those lanes can be opened back up? Are there still ongoing conversations with the owner? Through email, while out of town, Burnett had three short responses. You need to ask the owner, ASAP, and we have sent him notices as we are working through our attorney to require the building is brought into compliance with the code. Our next story. New MCHS group has links to extremism. A new student organization has formed in Mason City High School, whose roots can be found in the alt-right and with reported of extremism. Mason City High School TPUSA appears to have been founded in July this year, according to its Instagram account. The group is a local chapter of Turning Point USA, which was founded in Illinois in 2012 by Charlie Kirk, on the advice of Bill Montgomery, who heard Kirk speak at a local university when he was 18. Montgomery died in July of 2020 of COVID-19. The group touts that it has a presence in 2,500 college and high school campuses, including the North Iowa Area Community College, according to its TPUSA.com website. The nonprofit organization is best known for its professor watch list, which it says seeks to expose and document college professors who discriminate against conservative students and advance leftist propaganda in the classroom. Quote unquote. It also has a school board watch list, which it claims is America's only national grassroots initiative dedicated to protecting our children by exposing radical and false ideologies endorsed by school boards and pushed in the classroom, quote unquote. SBWL finds and exposes school board leadership that supports anti-American, radical, hateful, immoral, and racist teachings in their district, such as critical race theory, the 1619 Project, sexual gender ideology, and more. SBW also provides information on how parents and students can get involved in their local school board and put an end to the racialization of the classroom, quote unquote. Most recently, TPUSA has been rallying youth to combat vaccine mandates. Facebook ads have appeared from the organization urging people not to be quote-unquote forced to inject themselves with a quote-unquote experimental vaccine, according to a story in the Washington Post. Founder Kirk's website features articles touting the effectiveness of Intermicin, spelled I-V-E-R-M-E-C-T-I-N, as a treatment for COVID. Kirk and his TPUSA staff are no strangers to controversy. Some have been seen at national rallies with white supremacists, and some of its leaders have faced accusations of discrimination from former employees. At one TPUSA-sponsored event in Boulder, Colorado, alt-right speaker Milo Yiannopoulos, spelled Y-I-A-N-N-O-P-O-U-L-I-S, told the audience that he hated expletive lesbians and feminists who expletive hate men, according to a feature in the New Yorker magazine. Mason City Community Schools Policy 504.2 governs students-initiated, non-curriculum-based groups. Any organization that wants to use district facilities must get permission from the building's administrator, in this case, high school principal Dan Long. Long found the group was complying with district policy that it be student-initiated, use school facilities outside instructional time, not interfere with orderly school conduct, have only student members, and have an employee monitor the meetings, but not participate or assist, according to the email district communication liaison, Sue DeHickey, sent the Globe in response to questions about the group and the district's policies. DeHickey wrote that Long also consulted with Superintendent Dave Versteeg on the decision. According to flyers sent to the Globe, Mason City High School TPUSA has been holding weekly meetings at the high school under the supervision of teacher coach and sitting city councilor John Lee. Lee has a TikTok account at View from Teachers Row, where he has recorded videos recommending good books about history and touting the art and architecture of Mason City. Some of the educators' viewpoints made in his videos seem to align with those of TPUSA, including one that in which he suggests that modern-day Democrats are just today's slave owners, and that they believe in the paternal role of government to take care of those incapable of caring for themselves. In another video made with his wife, Lee says, "You might be brainwashed if you think it's necessary for kids to stay at home and learn online." Since the district does not take a position on student-initiated non-curriculum groups, Mr. Long and Mr. Lee would not have any comment, wrote Dieke in an email response to a request to interview them both about the group. Dieke did not respond to requests for interviews with the student organizer. In response to an email sent to the address on the group's Instagram page, an email from Hunter Siddell referred questions about the group to the national organization. The latest Instagram post showed what appears to be student staffing a booth in Clear Lake as part of the city's Thursdays on Main events in July. Another post shows what the caption says is the chapter's unidentified president and vice president walking with GOP candidate in the Clear Lake 4th of July parade. Other local TPUSA chapters have not had an easy go startup, as the Mason City High Schools did. Drake University and Cornell and Wartburg's colleges student senates have all rejected requests for TPUSA charters in recent years, claiming the organization is racist. Both the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center agree, noting the national organization promotes sexist and racist ideals. Our next story, Kleseth, K-L-E-S-A-T-H, was dedicated to Mason City Schools. Mother of five started teaching after her husband's death at age 42. Vernice Kleseth was married to the love of her life, mother to five children, and living a happy life as a homemaker and community volunteer. Little did she know that the part-time position she would take at Madison Elementary after the sudden death of her husband at 42 would lead to a decades-long career with Mason City Public Schools and result in an extended family of students, teachers, parents, and colleagues that would provide her love and support through the remainder of her life. Vernice began her career with MCPS, providing classroom support. She loved working with children, and especially those with special needs. She would eventually move into full-time administrative support roles at Roosevelt Junior High, Mason City High School, and the district office. She loved helping students and teachers any way she could, and every day had a special memory. In addition to her administrative responsibilities, Vernice also took on additional roles. For many years, she coordinated all the substitute teachers for the district. It meant an early start to the day, making calls to ensure classrooms were covered, but she took much joy in providing opportunities to new teachers. Vernice was often the person to greet you at the ticket booth at an athletic event over the years. It was a perfect way for her to check in with the students and families and cheer on her Mohawks. Vernice, with a bullhorn, was a common sight at graduation day, working hard to make the final day of high school a great one. Vernice's commitment to the MCPS went beyond her official duties. It was also reflected in the purchases of countless magazine subscriptions, pastries, and candies. It was working toward ensuring all children got the same opportunities to participate and feel included. It was being supportive of staff inside and outside of work. It was the commitment of building a better community. We'll continue with the story inside the paper, Iowa Redistricting Something for Everyone. Proposed new political maps in Iowa will dramatically alter the state's four congressional districts and 150 state house districts for the next 10 years. The potential political impact can already be measured on a congressional level, where both Democrats and Republicans stand to benefit. And the map provides yet another illustration of Iowa's declining rural and surging suburban populations. But are these proposed maps destined to guide Iowa's politics for the next decade? Or are they destined for rejection and the allure of something better? Those questions will not be answered until state lawmakers convene a special session of the Iowa Legislature on October 5th at the Iowa Capitol. To help analyze the proposed map's potential impact, the Bureau conducted email interviews with three Iowa political science professors: Timothy Hagel at the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford at Drake University, and Christopher Lenormier at University of Northern Iowa. Regardless of whether these maps are approved, they provide another illustration of how Iowa's population, like so many other states, is shifting from rural to urban and suburban areas. Iowa's congressional districts must be as equal as possible in population. In drawing the districts, the state's nonpartisan legislative services agency needed 44 counties in western Iowa's 4th district to match the population total of just 12 counties in eastern Iowa's 1st district. The one thing I can point to, whatever the final congressional map might be, is the continuing thinning out of rural Iowa, said Dennis Gulford, a political science professor at Drake University. Applied to new state legislative maps, we're seeing a strong concentration of population in urban areas, exacerbating the rural-urban political and cultural divide, and a lot of land area containing few people in the former, and not much land area containing a lot of people in the latter, he said. Meanwhile, a dive into some voting data behind the proposed maps illustrates their potential effects. At the congressional level, the biggest changes would come in eastern Iowa. If these proposed maps are approved, and there is far from any guarantee they will, the 1st and 2nd congressional districts will be looking nothing over the next decade like they did during the previous one. The new 1st district would retain just two of the same counties and contained from 2012 to 2021, Lynn and Jones. The other 10 counties? Yes, it would also shrink to a mere 12 counties, would all be new. The geographically, the 1st and 2nd districts would essentially make north and south swaps. The 1st would become a more compact southern-eastern Iowa district, and the 2nd a more expansive and more heavily northeastern district, stretching from the northern border of Winnipeg to Alameic counties to as far south as Wapello and Jefferson counties. Obviously, the flip in Iowa 1 and Iowa 2 in terms of geographic location, as well as a change in size for both districts, stood out, the Lenormier said. The 1st district's facelift also would be a political, and it would benefit Democrats. Using the state's most current voter registration numbers, Democrats would go from a voter registration edge of 3% points to an average of 10.1% points, or from total voter registration advantage of 14,244 to one of 46,870. Presidential voting numbers from 2020 elections in those counties suggest a similar Democratic boost in the new 1st. An analysis from Dave Wasserman of the National Cook Political Report showed that by using the presidential vote in the counties involved, the current 1st district went for Republican Donald Trump by 3.4 points in 2020. But the proposed counties for a new 1st district would have given the district to Democrat Joe Biden by 8.7 points, a massive 12-point swing to Democrats. But that comes with a trade-off, as the proposed new 2nd district would build upon momentum that has been building for Republicans in its current version. Under the proposal, the 2nd district's political leaning would essentially swap from a 2.8-point Democratic advantage to a 2.2-point Republican edge, in terms of pure voter registration numbers. The district would go from Democrats having 12,789 voter advantage to Republicans gaining the upper hand by 9,972 voters. Iowa 1 shrank geographically because it picked up Johnson and Scott counties while keeping Lynn, Hagel said. Those more populous counties forced more rural counties to be left to Iowa 2. Central Iowa's 3rd district would improve slightly for Democrats, moving their voter registration advantage there from just under 1% to just over 2 points. Perhaps just as important, Polk County would become an even bigger share of the overall district from 56.1 of its registered voters to 60.3. This is noteworthy because when Democrats win the district, they typically do so by only winning Polk County and driving up their margins there, while attempting to minimize their deficits in all other counties. Western Iowa's 4th District, a long-term conservative stronghold, see King Steve, would get even more Republican, and it would also get bigger. The proposed new 4th District would be 44 counties, pushing close to half of the state geographically. It would span as far northeast as Howard and Chickasaw counties, cut the state diagonally to include Fremont, Mills, and Montgomery counties in the southwest corner. Larimer and Hagel said they believed the proposed maps would create two consistently competitive districts, the second and third, while the fourth would remain a Republican lock and the first a strong Democrat district. In terms of competitiveness, we are likely to remain a state with three competitive districts and one safe district, Larimer said. If you look across the country for states with multiple congressional districts, Iowa sticks out in this regard in terms of the level of competition. I imagine we will once again be a state with at least two districts ranked among the most competitive in the country. Then there is the matter of 150 state house districts, 100 in the Iowa House and 50 in the Iowa Senate. As it regularly does, the redistricting process has tossed many sitting state lawmakers into the same newly proposed district. According to Iowa House staff members, in the House, there are 11 proposed districts that include two sitting Republican legislators, including one that roped in three, and another that includes both House Speaker Pat Grassley and Representative Shannon Latham. And there are four proposed districts that include two sitting Democrat legislators, all told that includes 31 legislators. Senate staff members did not respond to requests for similar information. Our redistricting method doesn't protect incumbents, and it often forces change among the legislators. That can be a good way to shake things up and get new folks in the legislature, Hagel said. Experience is good, but you don't want things to get stale. If state lawmakers reject this set of proposed maps during the special session, the Legislative Services Agency would create a second set of proposed maps. Lawmakers would then vote to accept or reject those. If the second proposal is rejected, lawmakers must approve LSA's third proposal, but legislators also would be able to amend those maps. We'll take a look at the In News section. First proposed new maps pop. A redistricting plan released this week would make major changes to Iowa's four congressional districts, including putting Linn and Johnson counties in what would become the new first district. No current members of the U.S. House are thrown into a district with another incumbent. However, the new map would put Democrat challengers in the current 1st and 2nd districts into the same new 1st district. The redistricting plan, which will be considered by legislators when they meet in special session October 5th, also redraws the 50 Iowa Senate districts and 100 House districts. Next, flautist visit. First Lady Jill Biden made a brief appearance at Des Moines Area Community College in Ankeny, where she stressed the need for the federal government to approve President Joe Biden's proposal for child care assistance and an extension of the monthly child care tax credit. Next, tweet trouble. Democrats and others blasted Iowa freshman Republican U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks for sharing a fake news article from a satirical online news website that falsely claimed Democrat President Joe Biden's administration was withholding health benefits from unvaccinated veterans. And lastly, Afghan evacuees. Iowa is expected to receive 695 Afghan evacuees from the first group of arrivals to be resettled in the United States. The Iowa Department of Human Services said in a statement that it is working closely with several agencies to coordinate the resettlement of Afghan refugees in Iowa. Next, judge blocks ban on mask requirements. A federal judge ordered the state of Iowa to immediately halt enforcement of a law passed in May that prevents school boards from ordering masks to be worn to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Judge Robert Pratt said in an order signed Monday that the law substantially increases the risk of several children with health conditions of contracting COVID-19. Several parents and the ARC of Iowa, a group that defends the civil rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, sued the state. Next, COVID death. An Iowa woman whose husband died from a breakthrough COVID-19 infection is blaming Americans who refuse to mask or get vaccinated. "It's that kind of attitude that killed my husband, Eredith Kupplinger, whose husband, Gary Kupplinger, of Mount Air, was buried this month," told the Des Moines Register. Next, settlement funds. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller said he wants financial proceeds from settlements with opioid manufacturers and distributors named in multi-state lawsuits to be directed towards treatment and recovery and abatement efforts to address addictions that claim at least 213 lives in Iowa last year. Next, strike authorization. Deere and company employees under the United States Auto Workers Local 865 Union voted to pass strike authorization. The vote does not indicate that Deere employees will strike, just that they are now authorized to do so if they feel it is necessary amid contract negotiations, which started in August. Next, the odds and ends portion of the In the News. U.S. are honoring the military. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, both Iowa Republicans, are leading an effort to honor American military members who served in Afghanistan. Next, the racial damage. Iowa's lost an estimated $20 million in annual benefits from its urban tree canopy that was damaged by the derecho in August of 2020, according to a report from the Iowa DNR. In our last In the News brief, gambling revenue, Iowans got a brief taste of college football last month, which helped boost legal sport wagering to $108.42 million, according to data issued by the State Racing and Gaming Commission. And that brings us to the midpoint of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, September 19th. You are listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service. It is a pleasure for me to read for you today. We'll continue today's reading to the opinion section. Today's opinion cartoon is, rumor has it, she's the only one who will get a perfect attendance award this semester. It's being said by two children near their lockers who are masked up, and they are pointing to what looks to be the picture of a germ who's unmasked walking around the hallways of a school. So that is today's cartoon. We'll continue our reading with the letter to the editor. First letter titled, Mason City Staffer Goes the Extra Mile. This may not be the right place for an attaboy, but I would like to thank Brian Pauley, Mason City Superintendent of Recreation and Golf. I'm a former resident of Mason City and well aware of the fine facilities at Margaret McNider Campground. Now that I am a full-time RVer and living out of my motor home, I wanted to return with other RVer friends for a get-together there. My motorhome had been planted at Forest City the day before my arrival, and I was appalled as tree branches on the streets and in the campgrounds were scraping my rig as I tried unsuccessfully to avoid all hazards. I commented on the city's website how I felt. The next day, Brian Pauley called me about my concerns and not only took responsibility for the park, but was going to pass it on to the street department. In a day when the pandemic gives everyone an excuse for lousy customer service or waiting on quote-unquote eternal hold to talk to a representative to order a back-ordered part, it was refreshing to know that Brian Pauley can still take responsibility for his job and still treat the public with respect. With an attitude like Brian's, perhaps all of us can come out on top of this pandemic. And that was signed Paul Patridge of Livingston, Texas. Our next letter, titled Turning Point USA, is a propaganda machine. Turning Point USA has targeted our high schools, including the Mason City High School. I have a problem with that. This isn't Young Democrats or Young Republicans groups I encourage. Adult supervision is provided in our parties, appearances to the contrary notwithstanding. TPUSA is a Murdoch cock propaganda machine, as the briefest look at their website will show you. This goes way beyond Brave New World and into Clockwork Orange territory. Before you wave First Amendment around, let me remind you that there is a protected class called the Captive Audience Doctrine. High schoolers definitely fall under that rubric. Privately, Culver's can decide to play Newsmax in their dining room, and I can choose not to go there. But public schools have a different set of rules. We are paying our tax dollars for schools to build responsible, informed citizens capable of making decisions. I applaud robust political dialogue on high school campuses. I remember studying William F. Buckley when prepping for debates. However, let's be responsible in instilling critical thinking skills in our students. TPUSA is an atheist of that and has no place in our high schools. Signed, Tracy Smith of Clear Lake. Our next letter to the editor, vaccine mandates equal too much government. John Skipper asks, how much government is too much government? I think being arrested for not reporting to Mercy One for your mandated monthly experimental gene therapy booster, which judging by all the concern about infection from vaccinated individuals seems to not even work is too much government. But since Mr. Skipper is so much more concerned about the public health and welfare than individual rights, I will take it upon myself to mandate. In the interest of public health and wellness that John Skipper and other health mandate advocates subsist entirely off of a diet of oatmeal and Brussels sprouts in a strict accordance with the USDA nutritional guidelines and the advice of professional nutrition experts. They will also be required to undergo a minimum of 30 minutes of cardiovascular exercise daily to proactively lessen the strain overweight and obese individuals pose to our healthcare system. People who eat ice cream and lounge about are very, very selfish, and so failure to comply with this mandate will result in Cerro Gordo Public Health revoking their nutritional passports, which will be required to patron local establishments and maintain employment. What's the issue? Isn't this what you want? Just pretend I'm the governor, and this is an executive order which I've declared a state of emergency regarding nutrition and the obesity epidemic. Signed, Ryan Shrupinick of Mason City. In our last letter, political parties are the problem. John Skipper is 100% correct in imagining a world without political parties, citizens working for each other and their country and not tearing our nation apart. The parties are not part of our official government. They have hijacked our election system and government. I would also like to question our government's involvement with primaries. The parties are separate entities from our government. They can fund their own processes. Signed, Michael Severson of Mason City. And that will go with today's opinion article, No Political Parties Isn't a Fantasy After All. Last week in this space, we explored what life would be like if there were no political parties in America, which seemed like a venture onto Fantasy Island. But the column drew a response from halfway across the country from a former Mason City man who knows what he's talking about. Herman Chip Folkers actually served in a government that has no political parties and says it works pretty well. Folkers served as a city attorney for Mason City for 21 years, retiring in 2003. At age 62, he looked for a new challenge. He thought about joining the Peace Corps when he stumbled across a job opening for a staff attorney to the Senate of the Federal State of Micronesia. He decided to apply for the job and he got it. Micronesia is a country comprised of many islands on the Western Pacific. At one time, it was under the administration of the United States, but has been an independent republic for about 40 years. Its government operates with no political parties and operates well according to Folkers. It has a unicameral Congress, meaning one legislative body, with 14 senators representing four different states, each with its own separate native language, multiple dialects, and distinct tribal customs. Despite the decidedly mixed culture, the senators were able to come together and conduct the national business in a way Washington could stand to learn from, said Folkers. It did help, he said, that in Micronesia, any form of confrontation is considered a cultural taboo. Over the 2 years I was in Micronesia, the senators didn't always agree, but their discussions were without exception, civil and void of personal attacks, said Folkers. The discussions almost always resulted in an outcome that enabled each of the senators with a feeling that had been heard, even if they were disappointed. It is interesting to note that as city attorney in Mason City, Faulkner served as government and whole city council members also are elected without political affiliation. His experience in Mason City and Micronesia are in stark contrast to the political climate in the United States. Congress, which is rampant with partisan division, our current two-party system has evolved into a self-destructive tribal loop. I'm not quite sure what the remedy is, said Faulkner, but alternatives need to be explored. He said some experts believe political parties are necessary to manage the politics of the country and believe that more viable political parties might be a better alternative than no political parties. At this point, the only thing I'm sure of is that our two-party system is broken, he said. Folkers and his wife Tucky now live in North Carolina and migrate to Florida during the winters. His 2 years in Micronesia gave him firsthand insight into how government and how good government can operate, though he realizes it's more applicable to small-town local government than a republic the size of the United States. It could never be a template for political change to our system, but it did provide some lessons on what it could be, he said. Fantasy Island, indeed. And with that, we will continue on to our obituary section. We begin with Miss Sandra Jackson. Sandra Figgleson Jackson, 84, of Littlefield, Arizona, passed away peacefully at home on September 8th with her family by her side. She was born October 28, 1936 in Charles City to Virgil and Cleo Myers Figgleson. She married the love of her life, Gordon Jackson, on September 22, 1956 in Nora Springs. Sandra loved her family, entertaining friends at their home, traveling and baking. She was a very supportive and encouraging wife, mother, and friend. Sandra has been cremated, a celebration of life to be held at a future date. The family would like to express a special thanks to Mesa View Hospice in lieu of flowers. Memorial contributions in Sandra's name can be made to Mesa View Hospice of Mesquite, Nevada. We'll continue with Joanne Marie Otterman. Joanne Marie Otterman went home to be with our Lord on Friday, September 17th. Family will greet visitors on Wednesday, September 22nd from 4 to 6 p.m. at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake. A funeral will be held on Thursday, September 23rd at 11 a.m., also at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, followed by interment at Clear Lake Cemetery. Just 11 days shy of her 89th birthday, Joanne led a wonderful, active life and didn't pass from the cancer she so vehemently fought, a decade earlier. Joan was born on September 28, 1932, to Clarence and Marie Thompson Christensen in Estherville, where she attended country school. She graduated from Gretatinger High School in 1950 and Hamilton Business College in Mason City in 1951. She worked as a secretary at various businesses in Mason City and Clear Lake, including Hinkle Construction Company, Custom Farm Services, and Handicap Village, now One Vision. She married Wallace Johnson in 1956, where they made their home in rural Clear Lake together. They had three children. As an active member of Zion Lutheran Church, she taught Sunday school, led Bible studies, served on church council, and bought home communion to shut-ins. She also served as hospice volunteer. She married Bill Otterman on April 5, 1997. Together, they wintered in Phoenix and enjoyed dancing, sightseeing, and visiting their families. Joan was a voracious reader, also solved daily crossword puzzles, and enjoyed walking, where she was known to walk at a brisk pace. She traveled to Norway, Hawaii, the Holy Land, and Denmark. She enjoyed cheering on the basketball teams, first the Iowa Hawkeyes and other professional teams, then supported the Iowa State Cyclones, where two of her granddaughters attended college. In 2010, she received the devastating news of tongue cancer. After a long 10-year of cancer treatments at Mayo Clinic, she was considered cured. Although she could no longer eat, she relied on feeding tube for sustenance. With her strong Christian faith and the power of prayer, she lived her last 10 years cancer-free. Next, Mr. Gary Taylor. Gary Taylor, age 61, of Leland, passed away Friday, September 17th at Good Samaritan Society in Forest City. A gathering of family and friends will take place from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, September 23rd at Schultz Funeral Home in Clark, in Forest City. A private family interment will happen at a later date. You can contact the family with online condolences. Next, Mr. Kevin Ray Mintz. Kevin Ray Mintz, age 64, of Meservey, passed September 7th at his home in Meservey of natural causes. As per Kevin's family wishes, there are no formal funeral services planned at this time. He will be laid to rest at the Meservey Cemetery near his parents Donald and Minnie. Memorials are suggested to the family in Belmont, Iowa, in Kevin's name, in an organization of the donor's choice. Kevin, the son of Donald and Minnie, was born October 9th, 1956 at Mason City. He attended Sheffield Chapin Meservey Thornton Community Schools, participating in football, track, and basketball, and graduated from SCMT High School, the class of 76. Following graduation, Kevin was employed at several co-ops in the area before commencing a career at Winnebago Industries in Forest City, where he worked in various departments and roles over a span of 25 to 30 years before his retirement. He was united in marriage to Robin Hogue, and their union was blessed with two sons. The couple later divorced. Over the years, Kevin enjoyed building models and shooting guns. He truly was an avid Hawkeyes and Minnesota Vikings fan, and barely missed watching one of their games on TV. He was also infatuated and had a very keen interest in World War II. Kevin lived in Meservey area for most of his life and was presently residing in his late parents' home. For many years, he lived a life of solitude. Condolences and memories may be left on the funeral home's website, virtual register, book under Kevin Mintz's obituary page. Next, Loretta Lori Waters. Loretta Lori Waters, 74, of Plymouth, passed on Friday, September 17th, at Mercy One Medical Center, North Iowa, in Mason City. A funeral service will be held on Tuesday, September 21st, at 10:30 a.m. at First Christian Church, with the Reverend Paul Bostrom officiating. Interment will be held in Oakwood Cemetery, Plymouth. Visitation will be held on Monday, September 20th, from 4 to 6 p.m. at Major Erickson Funeral Home. Memorials may be directed to the family of Lori Waters. Loretta Lee Waters was born on May 16th, 1947, to her parents Chet and Artith Anderson in Charles City. Lori graduated from Charles City High School in 1965. She went on to attend IACC, graduated with a degree in nursing. She worked as an RN for Mercy Hospital in Mason City for her entire career, and she retired in 2008. Lori was united in marriage to Junior Waters on May 8, 1972, in Juliet, Illinois. To this union, the couple was blessed with three children. In her spare time, Lori enjoyed reading books, cooking for her family, and spending time with her cats. She was an active member of the First Christian Church. Lori adored spending time with her family and often attended her children's and grandchildren's events when able. Lori was an amazing mother, grandmother, wife, and friend, and she will be deeply missed by those who knew her and loved her. Next, Mr. Darold Leo Elbert. Darold Leo Elbert, 86, of Mason City, passed away Friday, September 17th, surrounded by his family at his home in Mason City. Arrangements are in process. We continue with Reverend Monsignor, Joseph Slepka. Reverend Monsignor Joseph Slepka, 92, of Clear Lake and formerly of Mason City, passed Friday, September 17th at Muse Norris Hospice Inpatient Unit in Mason City. Massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 24th at Epiphany Parish Holy Family Catholic Church in Mason City. A live stream will be available on the Epiphany Parish Facebook page. Burial will follow in Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery. Visitation with public viewing will be held Thursday evening, September 23rd, at Epiphany Parish Holy Family Catholic Church from 5 to 7. The Third and Fourth Degree Knights of Columbus will pray the Rosary at 7 p.m. with the Scripture Wake service to follow. Epiphany Parish asks all to wear face masks at Mass and visitation. Lastly, Ms. Jeanette K. Harms. Jeanette K. Harms, 63, passed away of natural causes on Friday, September 17th, in her Hampton home. Funeral service will be at 2 p.m. Wednesday, September 22nd, at Hogan Brimmer Moore Colonial Chapel in Mason City. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior at 1 p.m. at the funeral home. All right, we'll turn over to our sports page, looking at our top story here, Lions Field Dynamic Healthy Rushing Duo. Return of Toby's sidekick Schmidt yields 1-0 district start. Clear Lake senior running back Jacker Schmidt has had 129 of rushing yards between the first three games of the season heading into Friday night's game at Osage. By the time the first quarter was over, Schmidt already had 100 yards on the ground against the Green Devils. He finished with over 200 yards and a score in a come-from-behind win over Osage. Clear Lake earned 39-32 victory in Class 2A District 3 action. Scats can be a little bit misleading, Clear Lake head coach Jared DeVries said. He didn't play running back the first 2 weeks. He was hurt. He didn't play week one. Week two, we didn't want him to run the ball. Really, last week was the first night at running back. Heck of a talent and heck of a competitor, proud of him. With the return of Schmidt to the backfield, the Lions now boost one of the top backfield tandems in all of Class 2A with Schmidt and senior quarterback Carson Toby. Toby, a dual-threat standout, has thrown for 9 touchdowns and rushed for over 5 through the first 4 games of the season. With a healthy Schmidt next to him, opposing defenses will be forced to prepare for 2 standouts. He's very nice to have alongside me, Toby said about Schmidt. He's my sidekick back there. It's nice to have him back. The return of a healthy Toby Schmidt duo couldn't have come at a better time. After winning their season opener, the Lions struggled the next 2 weeks. Clear Lake took a 47-23 loss to Algona in week 2 and a 48-17 loss to Dyke New Hartford in week 3. A win against Osage in the district opener was the perfect remedy for a forgettable 2-week stretch. It's huge. We needed a win, DeVries said. We didn't practice well this week. We were a little bit down on ourselves. For us to fight and come back, that was huge for us. Pair Toby and Schmidt with a group filled with dynamic playmakers on the perimeter, and the Lions have all the ingredients necessary to make up a successful offense. Turning around a defense that has given up 32 or more points in all 4 of the first few games will be the next item on the agenda for Clear Lake. Despite the non-district losses, all that matters now is district matchups. Right now, the Lions are a perfect 1-0. Of course, it's early, but Clear Lake's goal of winning this district championship is still very much attainable. That's the attitude we've all been talking about these next 4 weeks, Toby said. These are huge for us in the playoff talks. If we can win the rest of these district games and win our district, I really like where we're sitting. Clear Lake will host Gardner Hayfield Ventura at 7:30 p.m. on Friday at Lions Field. And our next story, Knights poses explosive backfield. Mazzino, Jennings are Newman's versions of Thunder Lightning. Jack Mazzino ran straight into his offensive lineman Friday night and found holes. James Jennings bounced to the outside and used his speed to break off a couple big gains. Together, they make Newman Catholic's ground game work and force opponents to think. James is definitely lightning, Mazzino said, and I slam it up the hole, I guess. Both have had their share in the spotlight through 4 weeks this season, but in the Knights' 37-21 victory over St. Agnes on the road, Mazzino and Jennings had equal parts in their Class A District 2 victory. Mazzino bullied his way through for 125 yards on 20 carries and 2 touchdowns from 1 and 6 yards out. Jennings finished with 83 total offensive yards and came and caught the game-stealing 4-yard touchdown pass in the fourth quarter. Both guys were quick to credit each other and the rest of the starting 11. Without him, the middle doesn't work, Mazzino said. He was on fire today. He's getting 8 yards on a play. That's developed to go 5 yards, Jennings added. At the end of the day, this wouldn't happen without everybody else. You guys wouldn't be interviewing unless it wasn't for them. Coach Rich McArdle stated that the two tailbacks had flipped positions this season. Mazneo moved into the fullback role and Jennings switched from the left side to the left side of the backfield. They're starting to hit their stride and they're starting to get a feel for what they need to do in the offense, McCurdle said. Mazneo and Jennings have shared a bond through football. They hang out outside of practice too. It's made their on-field connection stronger through New Catholic's 3-1 start. The Knights get unbeaten North Butler for their homecoming game next week. They are far from overlooking one of two unbeatens in this district. You overlook them, bad things happen, Mazneo said. And that will take us on over to Dear Amy. Title drawing line at dating apps. Dear Amy, I was in an exclusive monogamous relationship with a man for 8 months, and unfortunately I kept catching him using dating apps, even after I had drawn a hard boundary about it. He would go dark and fall out of communication and then deflect onto me why I would ask him why. So finally, after a week of him being particularly inconsiderate and insensitive, I broke off our relationship. Now he wants to go in for couples counseling, even though when I was with him, he refused to listen to me about even the simplest thing, like deleting his dating apps. I don't know why he wants to go to counseling now that he's completely repelled me. I'd really like your take on this. Signed, Curious. Dear Curious, I agree with you that deleting needs to happen. You need to do the deleting, and what you need to lose is him. You were feeling good about how you ended things, but if you allow him to draw you back in, you won't even have that. Counseling is a great idea, especially for him. If he wants to enter therapy in order to figure out how and why he sabotaged the relationship with you, then let him do so, and perhaps at some point in the future, he will be inspired to try to prove to you that he has changed. All right, a quick recap of the weather. High today, 89, low of 65 was Sunday. Monday, high of 73, low of 48. Tuesday, high of 69, low of 42. Wednesday, high of 67, low of 42. And Thursday, high of 71, low of 48. Time for those jackets, everybody. So I have been your reader, Glorietta, and it's been my pleasure to read for you today on IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service. Stay safe, everyone.